Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. First, a couple of updates. As regular listeners know, we've been following the efforts over more than a year to get those two members of Pussy Riot, Nadia and Maria, out of their respective cold, harsh Russian prisons for hard labor. And yesterday, the Russian parliament voted 446-0 in favor of freeing, at first it said 2,000 political prisoners. On the news reports this morning, the New York Times says 25,000 political prisoners, including all those imprisoned for so-called hooliganism, which includes the so-called Arctic 30, who are the crew of the Greenpeace boat that was confiscated. And it also includes, of course, those two members of Pussy Riot. And by the way, it's reported that they were a punk rock group. In interviews since then by other members who have been disguised and talking to the media in Europe and elsewhere, they're not actually a punk rock group. They were young women who were almost all art students, and it was really a performance piece that was also protest art. And they went into the big cathedral in Moscow, and right under all the glorious icons filling this one large wall, they performed a song that was a prayer to the Virgin Mary. And it said, "Mother Mary, please save Russia from Putin." So I played that song for you earlier this year, so you could see what all this was about. They did this protest art on February 21st, 2012, and were sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. And I think we should remember here that at the time, a tip of the hat to Angela Merkel, who during a state-level visit with Putin got right in his face and said, "Vladimir, don't you think 2 years of hard labor is an excessive sentence for expressing a political opinion?" So good for her, but that didn't do it. What did it, of course, is that Russia is soon to host the Winter Olympics, and so they're trying to clean up their evidence here of being disregarding of human rights in many, many cases. So it looks like all these people are going to be freed any moment now. At first, they thought maybe it would even be today, but it should be in the next few days. Fingers crossed. And then, on another subject we're involved with here, the global climate crisis, we've had the National Projects Coordinator, the Actions Coordinator from 350.org on this program at the beginning of this year. And they sent out an email a couple days ago letting everyone know that utterly admirable, in my estimation, Bill McKibben has a new article out today in Rolling Stone on this subject. The title of it is "Obama and Climate Change, the Real Story." So I want to just read you one paragraph from this just to give you a sense of what this reveals, although Bill is very even-handed here. He's very calm. I think anyone might feel like screaming as they read this, but it could have said much more because he is trying to reach a very broad audience with it. But anyway, here's a little excerpt from it. In October, that is a couple months ago, when activists pressed President Obama about the Keystone Pipeline at a Boston gathering, he said, quote, "We had the climate change rally back in the summer," unquote. And then Bill McKibben, "In fact, that unwillingness to talk regularly about climate change may be the greatest mistake the president has made. An account in Politico last month described his chief of staff dressing down Nobel laureate and then Energy Secretary Stephen Chu in 2009 for daring to tell an audience in Trinidad that island nations were in severe danger from rising seas. Rahm Emanuel called his deputy Jim Messina to say, quote, 'If you don't kill Chu, I'm going to,' unquote." On the plane home, Messina told Chu, how exactly was this frigging on message? Unquote. It's rarely been on message for Obama, despite the rising damage. So, you know, if you separate out Rahm Emanuel's reputation in Washington for being a very aggressive, unpleasant person, the attitude, the position, the factual, if privately held, secret position of the administration, like a lot of the rest of the government, has just apparently been to act as a handmaiden to the energy corporations. And I think the big tip-off, which I didn't see in this article, I only had time to scan it quickly, but I'll go back to it now. And I'm not sure he mentions what to me was really the smoking gun that the fix is in, and that is that a few months ago it was reported that the chief U.S. trade negotiator for Europe had been over there trying to convince the EU to accept the oil that's going to be piped down from the Alberta tar sands across our precious groundwater systems, this very gunky, the worst kind of crude oil, down to those ports on the coast of Texas, and then export it. It's all for export. It's not for us achieving any energy independence. So he's over there hustling for these companies. Will you take this product from these American corporations, which, as Bill McKibben pointed out in a previous Rolling Stone article, is just going to put us way over the top in terms of carbon emissions. Not only are all the reserves now booked in to the energy corporations, the oil corporations' plans, and also booked into their stock prices, if all that were burned, it would be completely disastrous. But to go and be excavating new fields at a time like this, I mean, I've been in this green activism since the 70s, and I don't think anyone could have imagined such a scenario. If you would have said back then, what do you think is going to happen when the oil starts to peak? By that time, of course, photovoltaics have come down in price. I mean, it would be very possible to have a big program getting solar panels on every roof in America, plug in your car to the special outlet in your garage at night. Very sane ways to get energy independence while cutting our carbon emissions. But instead, it's going to be full bore for all kinds of new excavation methods and fields, including since 2005 when Cheney got what's called the Halliburton loophole put into the Energy Act of 2005, saying that these toxic chemicals could now be used. Hydraulic fracturing prior to that point was not widely used because of the toxic chemicals. But he got this little line slipped in that said, henceforth, the extraction process known as hydraulic fracturing will be exempt from the U.S. Clean Water Act. And just bingo, all these fracking companies sprang up across the country who now use the toxic chemicals under pressure to get more oil and gas out. And if you've been following this, you've probably read in the media stories saying, well, it really wouldn't be a good idea to have solar panels on every house because our grid's not built for that. It's built for one-way electricity delivery from these big centralized plants to the houses. But fortunately, clever people, I believe there's some young professor at MIT, I saw an article about, have figured out you could have local systems that would redirect the energy. For instance, if your house were producing extra electricity, it could be routed locally to where it's needed, like the hospital or the fire department or something. So there are ways that we could proceed with going solar, but that's just not on the table. Why? It's the same reason there are so many self-destructive votes going on in Washington and state legislatures, because of our system of funding elections until we have campaign finance reform. Practically every vote is corrupt. They vote to suit the big donors, the big corporate donors. They have to keep them pleased because they're desperately in need of more big campaign contributions. So that's why we hardly have an energy policy. And what is spoken about is, it's really morally criminal. But on the brighter note, let's move into our topic today, which, unlike our continuing slide into ecocide, is not at all maddening. And by the way, I mention all those things I just did because we can still do things about it. You know, we have the numbers. They have the money, but we have the numbers, and they're desperate to stay in office, so think about it. But this topic we're going to move into is very closely related to what I'm absolutely fascinated with. If you listen to this program off and on, you've probably caught on that it's about dynamic interrelatedness as an overarching theme. And when I was invited by PRN to create a program, I thought, oh, I would really be interested in continuing to learn about all these recent discoveries that I gathered together and put into the book Relational Reality in 2011. So this way I get to keep hearing about all these kind of amazing discoveries. And our guest today is right in this ballpark. He's really one of the experts with a bird's eye view of so much that's being discovered in the area of psychology. That's only one of the areas in what I call relational reality, this whole shift to realizing that physical reality, including the human body-mind, is just way, way more dynamically interrelated in structure and function than we ever supposed. So, my guest today is Daniel Goleman. He's a psychologist who's widely known for his best-selling book, Emotional Intelligence, which has now been translated into 40 languages. His new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence, delves into new findings from neuroscience labs and explains why attention is a little-noticed mental asset that makes a huge difference in how well we find our way in our personal lives, our careers, as parents and partners, and in virtually everything we do. Like a muscle, use attention poorly and it withers. Work it in the right way and it strengthens. Daniel Goleman holds a PhD in psychology from Harvard. And he did not put that in his bio paragraph, but I'm putting it in there because why not? He earned it honestly. And that was back in our day before great inflation, folks. I'm just putting it out there. You betcha. Anyway, Daniel Goleman is a founder of the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, which encourages school programs on cultivating emotional intelligence abilities like self-awareness and empathy, and now on enhancing children's focus of attention. Daniel Goleman, welcome to the program.
Hi, Charlene. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, this is a very interesting book. And before I get into some of my questions, I want to start more or less the way you do. I think when we say focus of attention, what arises in people's minds is, what is happening? What is the status of our focus of attention in our hypermodern culture? Would you say it with the young people, you know, it seems from a non-scientific view to be under onslaught when they're raised on an electronic immersion. And Is it really eroding, or does it just seem that way to us?
Well, I think it's definitely challenged. I've been talking to teachers, for example, who tell me that kids now will be in class texting each other, not listening to what the teacher is saying. Some schools have started to ban phones from the classroom. Some schools give kids iPads that have the textbooks on them, but you can also download your favorite video game on that. I think what's happening is that kids are growing up in an environment unlike when, you know, those of us who are adults were kids, where there are some rather seductive, insidious distractions
that
intrude on their ability to concentrate, and you know, that ability to concentrate is the essence of being able to learn. It's also, by the way, getting into the way of relationships. And this is not just kids, it's adults. You'll see, you know, a couple out to dinner, a romantic candlelit, whatever, and they're looking at both looking at their phones or not looking at each other's eyes. And I think it's intruding in ways that we haven't noticed, but we need to take some action about, because it's invading our private space. It's invading our ability to concentrate on that book we're reading, on that idea that we want to pursue, on you know, intellectual work, as well as our relationships and private lives. So I think that as a result, this generation of kids, I think, may need more help in amping up the concentration than has been true in the past.
Yeah. Well, it certainly degrades one's presence. The person who's looking at it is not present to the other person.
Yeah.
And that's a big, big part of being human. This is one of those areas, like the two that I talked about earlier, where I just find it maddening. I first started mentioning this in a book in 1991, States of Grace, and at that time it wasn't with scientific research. It was anecdotal stories from professors and teachers noticing differences in students' thinking patterns. But, you know, it's been going on so long, and it's like there was this gigantic experiment. What would happen if you put children in the formative years on these electronic devices and then kept them on it? And, you know, our children are the guinea pigs. So it seems there's more and more evidence, and yet there's nothing addressing it in a comprehensive way. We'll get to some of these interesting techniques that are being used in schoolrooms with young children to try to help them to cultivate a focus of attention and their natural presence without taking away from that. So I think that's interesting, but overall, it just seems to be rolling on in this massive way.
Well, you know, in 2007, there was a small squib in Time magazine that said, there's a new word in the English language, it's pizzled. It's a combination of puzzled and pissed off, and it means it's how you feel when the person you're with takes out their BlackBerry and starts talking to someone else. That was 5 years ago. Now that's the norm. Nobody uses a BlackBerry anymore either. It shows you how things have changed. But what it means is the norms for attention are changing. And the norms for attention, I think, affect everything from how kids learn to 350, actually. And I hope we get into that, because the inability of people to focus on global warming, you know, as you said, ecocide, is very dangerous. I think it traces back to some new findings about the human brain.
Yeah. Oh, well, we'll get into that definitely. When you combine the fact that, you know, we're made for a more close-in focus, and this is a global problem, combine that with the fact that the energy corporations are pushing hard in the other direction, and of course controlling so much of the media, that does make for a very dangerous situation.
Well, it's like classic misdirection of attention. Here's the thing. I mean, you talk about relational systems. The human systems, like energy systems or transportation systems or construction or industry and commerce, have built into them a systematic attack on the global systems that support life on the planet. And the poster child is definitely carbon. And, you know, Bill McKibben is absolutely right. We need to pay attention to this. An alarming piece of data that someone, an environmental activist, told me was that after Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, fewer people were interested in an environment issue than before.
And wow.
I've been thinking about that, and I realized that it has to do with two things. One is that the brain's alarm system, as you point out, and perceptual system, is fine-tuned in evolution for a different era. It was when we had predators, physical predators, tigers, saber, you know, bears attacking us, or we needed to attack something else. So our emergency alarm system and our perceptual system is gauged to a different range of reality, a different range of relationship, if you will, than the global changes that are happening as a result of what the energy companies are doing and so on, which those changes are too macro or too micro for the human perceptual system. We hear about them, but we don't directly perceive them. Not only that, our alarm system, which is very concerned with physical threats or symbolic threats that are immediate, doesn't care. So this creates a mismatch with three systems, the human system, the brain, our industry, commerce, energy, and so on, and the global system. Not only that, as you pointed out just before you shifted topic, it's very depressing to think about what's happening. In fact, I think this is why people tune out. As a psychologist, I know if you want to motivate people, for example, if you want women to be more aware of breast cancer, if you want people to stop smoking, there's lots of data from public health that says don't scare them. That turns people off. The more effective thing to do is mobilize the sense that each person can do something, take some control, and can keep marching. I wrote a book called Ecological Intelligence, which argued that we need to be more transparent about the impacts of everything we buy and do. And there's a methodology for this. It comes from industrial ecology called life cycle assessment. You can look at anything that's made and look back in its history, break that history down into analyzable steps. There may be hundreds, thousands. At each step, you analyze emissions into air, water, soil, toxic chemicals, and so on, and you get a total profile of the negative footprint of that product. And then you can compare products. There's a very good website, Good Guide, that does this for tens of thousands of consumer products. But that is just the beginning, because knowing the footprint of what you do and what you buy is actually pretty discouraging. So there's a group, the Harvard School of Public Health, that flips it around. They say, take your footprint as your baseline and then focus on your handprint. Your handprint is everything you do to lower your footprint.
And that was very interesting in the book.
And the handprint mobilizes a reward system in the brain, actually. Hey, I did pretty well. I lowered my handprint. Let's keep going. It motivates people. And I'm advocating that we start getting kids to track their handprint and teach them this relational thinking, systems thinking, how human activity impacts the planet and what they can do about their contribution to that by enlarging their handprint.
Right. I do think all this is very important. It is in the category of activism called lifestyle changes, and we still have to focus on institutional changes, which is, where the big guns pull out their influence in our government. But, I want to back up a minute here to what we often hear the cognitive scientists say. Well, our brains were made for this shorter range focus of what's going on. But all the traditional indigenous cultures that anthropologists have been able to research, had a sense of the cosmological, even bigger than the planetary, that we were embedded in this cosmological drama. And by the way, one of the Earth's holy days is coming up Saturday, the winter solstice. Don't forget to mark that, everyone, and plug your mind into the grand drama that we live in. So, they had this very large focus, and they saw themselves as derivative, situated, embedded in the cosmos, the land, and then the clan. And I think probably a problem that we lost that with modernity, that's just, old-fashioned primitive thinking, means we did get shrunken down to what's the effective set of data we should focus on right in front of us. So I still think we could maybe pump it up, but the political systems have to be addressed as well as all those important things. I think the handprint is extremely interesting to show people, the positive effects they can make. Anyway, I want to back up here to the beginning of the book where you explain this new cognitive research on the two kinds of functions within our brain. For shorthand, you call them then the two brains, the bottom-up mind, the two minds, the bottom-up mind and the top-down mind. So could you explain those to the listeners?
The top-down mind is it's mostly we call it top-down because it's mostly at the top of the brain in terms of the circuitry involved, but it also is the part of the brain where we can be intentional, where we can plan, where we can be of critical analysis, where we can think things through, where we can make good decisions. It's where we can mobilize our best talents. The bottom-up brain is where our automatic habits and routines take over. It's also where our emotions emerge from. You know, emotions, we don't plan our emotions. They come unbidden and spontaneously. And then the top-down brain tries to handle them in some way. But emotions are the most powerful distractors. And I think that I don't want to alarm you, but it's interesting to me that some of the state-of-the-art research being done on top-down distractors, bottom-up distractors, rather, is being done by marketing people. In other words, in the service of advertising, the service of designing websites and so on, they're using brain research to plan how best to distract us from the thing we want to do and make us look at the thing they want to sell us. And advertising.
Okay, good, because in that 1991 book, I said mindfulness is the only thing that's going to save us from these advertisers' psychological tricks.
Well, I totally buy it, because mindfulness is top-down. Mindfulness means becoming aware of your own awareness, so you can notice, hey, I'm being seduced again by another clever distractor.
Yeah.
And that gives us a choice point in the mind that we don't have otherwise. So I think that the more we can cultivate the capacity to manage our own attention rather than have it managed for us, the freer we are as individuals. And I'm very much in favor of having this done for kids, because it means they're better able to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned visiting a school in Spanish Harlem, where kids are really, you know, from tough backgrounds, traumatic, chaotic. They live in a housing project next to the school. These second graders, every day, have an exercise they do called breathing buddies, where they take a little stuffed animal, they find a place to lie down on the floor, put that animal on their belly, and they watch it rise as they breathe in, and fall as they breathe out. They count 1, 2, 3 on the in-breath, 1, 2, 3 on the out-breath. And what it does is sharpen that faculty for concentration. It's called cognitive control, and it turns out to be a stronger predictor of how well someone does in life, both in terms of their financial stability and their health. It's a stronger predictor than IQ or the wealth of the family you grew up in. So I think
cognitive control.
Cognitive control. And
great.
It can be...
I would like you to say, explain a little more about the bottom-up mind, but we have to pause here for a break, and then we'll come back. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Daniel Goleman, author of the new book, Focus. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Daniel Goleman, author of the new book, Focus. His website address is danielgoleman.info. That's danielgoleman.info. And there's information there about all his books. Emotional intelligence, social intelligence, ecological intelligence. So let's go back to having you say a bit more about the bottom-up mind, because in the book you say awarenesses break through from time to time into the conscious prefrontal cortical areas from this subcortical area. So does that mean that this is the physical location of what used to be called the unconscious?
Probably, yeah. The cortex is the added on in evolution later part of the brain that thinks, that manages information. The subcortex, which is literally below it, a larger part of the brain, is the part of the brain we share in common with other mammals, for instance. It's a more primitive part of the brain. It was designed for survival. Emotions are actually the way the brain gets us to pay attention to something, like a danger over here and to do something immediately. It's very compelling. And interestingly, as we go through life and experience things that work, things that don't, we gather decision rules that are stored in the deepest part of the subcortical brain, the basal ganglia. And this is, in a sense, our life experience. So when we face a decision point, should I marry this guy as opposed to the other people I've dated? Should I leave my job for another? What strategy should we follow going into the future? Whatever it may be, this part of the brain gives us the answer on the basis of our life wisdom. But it doesn't have any connectivity to the part of the brain, the top-down brain, that thinks in words. It actually connects richly to the gastrointestinal tract. So it gives us the answer in a felt sense. It feels right or it doesn't feel right. This is intuition. And that's very important data, because this is what everything that we know tells us, as opposed to what the world is telling us.
What that's most, with all the new mind-body research, and of course mind-body should really be written as one word because it's a coherent organism, but the gut-brain connection and all kinds of modes of perception throughout the body, probably it's this subcortical part of the brain that's the one that's most connected to all those subtle body messages rather than the neocortical. Would that be right?
Yes, and in fact, once we get that felt sense, then the top-down brain puts it in words. But we get the message first from this intuitive part of the brain, which is much more connected to the body, as you point out.
Yeah. Well, I think, as some people have said, our culture tends to not value the intuitive messages, and we're really educated and socialized just to pay attention to our rational interior monologue, these sentences going across our interior screen, and it's a skill we can cultivate to pay attention to those messages popping up then from this older brain, because they're in touch with this deeper range of information gathering. If there's it's just sort of like a little blip that comes up, we tend to like put that in the back of our minds and not pay attention to it, instead of really say, oh, wait a minute, what was that? What was that? I want to pay attention to that. What was that?
There's a brain area, top of the bottom-up brain.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
There's a brain area, which is at the top of the bottom-up brain. It's called the insula, which senses the internal signals from the body. And we can get better at becoming aware of what's going on by doing any practice regularly that allows us to tune into those signals. It could be like a body scan, just sensing the sensations in your body. That actually strengthens the connectivity that allows us to sense what's going on, to pick up those subtle signals.
So that's probably what was happening in biofeedback as well.
Biofeedback, neurofeedback. There are many, many ways to do it. But I think classically, traditionally, spiritual systems have known this.
Uh-huh.
Have encouraged people to tune in that way. And now neuroscience is saying, hey, what do you know? The brain is plastic. It changes with repeated experience. And if you practice something like that, you strengthen your ability and the connectivity in the brain for doing that very thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have one more question about this very interesting chapter. Of course, these concepts run through the whole book of the bottom-up mind and the top-down mind. But, you know, you say you can sit down at a book or whatever you're reading and have intentional concentration so that you can read. But sometimes you sit down with material and it seems that, I guess it's close to that state you were mentioning that's well known as flow, but it seems as if you're drawn into it. I wonder if it feels, and not to be too poetic and not scientific, but it feels like a qualitatively different kind of reading. You can't will it. It's just sometimes you're in it, and time seems to stop. You know, I'll have a cup of tea I just made, and I won't even remember to drink it. because I've been drawn in this way that feels like gray space. It feels very special. And so I wonder, is that kind of engagement with the material the same kind, just coming in from a different direction as the directed intentional concentration, or is it something different?
Because that kind of concentration becomes effortless. And that marks a big brain change. You get into the state called flow that you mentioned. It's a state, interestingly, of maximal cognitive efficiency. So you're taking in what you're reading at your best, and you're making connections. That's why it gets very exciting, and you're totally absorbed.
Yeah.
The key marker in our experience for this is 100% concentration. You don't notice the tea next to you. In fact, you don't notice anything else. You're so taken and completely involved in what you're reading. And there's another marker which is really interesting. It feels good. It's actually a very pleasant state. Don't you agree?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And it's the analog of that, by the way, in relationship, in interactions, is when we feel simpatico with someone. When we're really in rapport, we have 100% mutual attention, and it feels good. It's interpersonal flow.
Uh-huh. Okay, I want to get in to how it's possible for us to train our focus of attention, as you say, if we look at it as a mental muscle. But first, I'd like to talk about this big, interesting area you mentioned a bit, about the correlation between power and powerlessness and who pays attention or not. So how does that work?
Well, this is a little boggling and has immense political implications. There's a group at Berkeley, at the University of California, that has been studying the relationship between social power and attention. And they find that the more powerful person, the more wealthy, the higher status, in an interaction, face-to-face, pays less attention to the other person.
Oh.
And it shows up in many other ways. If you look at an organization, the people at the top take longer to return an email from the people at the bottom. There are many metrics for this, but what it says is that there is an empathy gap that follows power lines, because the more you notice the other person, for example, people at the bottom pay lots of attention to people at the top, as well as to people at their own level in their community and so on. They've got a very good panoramic empathy, but the people at the top have a kind of stunted attention, which means they don't tune into the other person.
They don't understand their reality.
So think about this. It means that people who are making political decisions are doing it on the basis of very little or no understanding of how it impacts the lives of people who don't have the power they do.
Yeah, sure seems that way. Huh. You told that story about being in a restaurant and listening to a friend talk about something dramatic that had happened to him. He was very engaged in telling you the story, and he went on and on and hadn't even eaten his food, and you'd eaten your whole meal, and the plate had been taken away, and he's still going on and on telling you about this thing that happened. And then the waitress comes over to him and says, how did you like your meal, or how was your meal?
The waiter says to him, are you enjoying your food? And my friend says, no, not yet. Because he assumed he had said, are you finished?
Yeah,
it's because he wasn't paying attention.
What would this serving person be about to say? You know, I'll just preempt that and jump on it. I don't need to listen to her even say it. And it reminded me of this cartoon that was in the New Yorker years ago, where this couple, married couple, was sitting down to dinner, and the bubble over the wife's head said, you've ignored me totally for 20 years. I can't stand anymore. I've poisoned your food. You'll be dead in 10 seconds.
Uh-huh.
And the husband's reply is, could we talk about this later? I'm not really feeling very well. So, it does play out in the power dynamics, but surely that explains why Congress is just making mind-bogglingly callous decisions lately about disadvantaged people in our country.
Well, I think it's half the equation. I think the other half is what you mentioned earlier, which is political contributions. The distortion that money brings to the political system so that there's a big incentive to make decisions that favor people that have lots of money, but there's little incentive except to get elected if you need to in your district help out people with little power.
Yeah. But some of the comments they make are just really astounding. Well, there's so many interesting sections in the book, this anatomy of attention, self-awareness, how to read others, and smart practice. What is it then people can do to get a little better with our focus of attention?
Well,
including your work with children, both adults and children.
Well, the bad news is that attention is being attacked, and kids particularly may not be learning the basics that they need for life.
Mm.
And also it declines again late in life. The good news is that we don't have to let that be the case, because these systems in the brain are very plastic in the sense that they can be strengthened like a muscle through regular exercise. And the way you strengthen the ability to pay attention is through, for example, what I was talking about with the breathing buddies, where those seven-year-olds in Spanish Harlem are watching the breath rise and fall. What that means is when their mind wanders and they notice it's wandered, they bring it back. That moment of mindfulness and then bringing the mind back turns out to be the basic move in the mental gym. Anything we do, for example, mindfulness is becoming very popular now in business and schools and so on. Anything we do that keeps our attention in one place and lets us notice when the mind wanders off. The mind, on average, wanders 50% of the time. But when we want to do mental work, when you're reading that book, when you're doing your homework, when you're trying to get that project done, you need to pay intentional attention. And when your mind wanders off and you get distracted, you're lost. And, of course, our digital world is pulling at us as well as the way our brain is wired. So doing some kind of mental exercise, the meditations of all the world traditions, if you strip away the belief system, you have a mental exercise for attention. And all of them have the same basic dynamic, which is to help us notice where our attention is and bring it back to where we want it to be. That's the basic move. And there's now a very large amount of data at the brain level that shows that this not only increases connectivity, but it increases concentration ability and also, very interesting, makes it more calm. It's the same circuitry in the brain that's used to manage disturbing emotions as well as to focus on what we want to be paying attention to. And so I'm advocating that kids learn this in schools like they're doing in Spanish Harlem. I think the teachers say that those kids, by the way, half the kids in this class have special needs, it's called, things like ADD or learning disabilities, Asperger's spectrum, and so on. And you'd expect the classroom to be very chaotic, but I was surprised at how calm and focused they are.
Hmm.
Teachers say it speeds up emotional maturity about 2 years.
Hmm.
So the second graders are acting like fourth graders, which is more able to manage their attention.
What did it mean that one teacher said this really works best in combination with SEL, social and emotional learning? What are these
social
two systems that
learning.
Are being brought together?
Yeah. Social-emotional learning is a shorthand, rather awkward shorthand, for programs that teach emotional intelligence skills like self-awareness, managing your inner world, your disturbing emotions, knowing what to do with them, empathy, tuning into the person you're with, and getting along with other people, social skill, collaboration, teamwork, all of that. And there are now probably a couple hundred different curricula that teach these skills from K through 12, some with different emphasis. Some are anti-bullying emphasis, some are just help kids generally pay attention better. What they found is that the campaigns to stop bullying or to lower violence, to increase tolerance, whatever it may be, whatever some programs that had those focus earlier on worked and some did not. Those that worked had this same basic substructure, which is increasing kids' ability to manage their inner world and to get along with other people. So that's what SEL is.
Mm-hmm.
And this program in Spanish Harlem is coupled with an SEL. So, for example, those second graders, when they feel really upset and, you know, kids wouldn't play with me on the playground, they have a place called the Peace Corner where you can go and just be with yourself
mm-hmm.
and handle your feelings. They have kids who, older kids who are trained to be peacemakers on the playground when kids aren't getting along. So it's a holistic program. They also try to involve parents and the teachers. The culture of the school changes this way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an atmosphere where kids are encouraged to learn these skills, to share them, to get along.
Mm-hmm. You have also quite a bit in here about leadership, and we just have about a minute left, but I think a lot of my listeners are involved with social change work. Could you give a couple of directional hints or tips about leadership that would be applicable? And then I refer people to get more information by looking at the book Focus, but what about that?
Well, I talk about the three kinds of focus that a leader needs. One is on yourself, to lead yourself. It means being very aware, knowing your values, your what you're motivating yourself, managing your attention and your disruptive emotions so they don't get in the way of what you want to do or learning from them. The second is empathy, tuning into people, to the people in your organization, the people on your team. And the third is understanding the larger systems, the political systems, the economic systems, whatever they may be, that are impacting the work you're doing. And so I'm saying that leaders need all three of these.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, that is all the time we have. And Daniel Goleman, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay. Let's move over to the Arts Corner and see what we have today. Next week is Christmas. So instead of a poem, let's hear a passage from A Child's Christmas in Wales by Dylan Thomas. He wrote this in 1945 and added to it a bit in 1947. And here in this part, he's telling the story of a Christmas adventure he had as a boy. And I remember that we went singing carols once when there wasn't the shaving of a moon to light the flying streets. At the end of a long road was a drive that led to a large house, and we stumbled up the darkness of the drive that night, each one of us afraid, each one holding a stone in his hand in case, and all of us too brave to say a word. The wind through the trees made noises as of old and unpleasant, and maybe web-footed men wheezing in caves. We reached the black bulk of the house. What shall we give him? Hark the Herald? No, Jack said. Good King Wenceslas. I'll count three. One, two, three. And we began to sing, our voices high and seemingly distant in the snow-felted darkness round the house that was occupied by nobody we knew. We stood close together near the dark door. Good King Wenceslas went out on the Feast of Stephen. And then a small, dry voice, like the voice of someone who has not spoken for a long time, joined our singing. A small, dry eggshell voice from the other side of the door. A small, dry voice through the keyhole. And when we stopped running, we were outside our house. The front room was lovely. Balloons floated under hot water bottle gulping gas. Everything was good again and shone over the town. For our song this week, we hear a French Christmas carol from the 16th century, En flambeau, Jeannette, Isabelle, which means, bring a torch, Jeannette, Isabelle, Come quickly to the stable. The Christ child is born. Tell all the villagers. This arrangement is sung by the Stairwell Carolers. Here it is. That was En Flambeau, Jeannette, Isabelle. Merry Christmas, and don't forget to have a very happy solstice this Saturday. It's the coming of the light. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you would like to see who my guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Next week, my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today, on January 2nd, to start the new year with Marianne Williamson, author of a new book, A Year of Miracles, and she's running for Congress. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that we know.